Hello and welcome. You're tuned into the best in true crime talk radio. This is True Crime Tuesday with your ailing host, Darkness Dave. I'm still here, punching my way through, guys. I don't know, if you are not prepared for the flu this year, you've got to. Go get the flu shot. I take my flu shots, and this is the one year I think I skipped, and it's beating me up pretty roughly. So if you're on that fence post, and if you don't want the flu shot, make sure you're staying clear of people. Avoid this, because whatever it is has started to hibernate inside me and grow like the alien from the movie series. It has become a life unto itself, burrowing into my chest and head. So not a pleasant experience, but I hope all of you are doing well. This new year is finding you healthy, happy, and having a good time. We are back at it with True Crime. We've got some really great stuff coming up for you this season. I think you guys are really going to like. And tonight we've got an interesting guest joining us. His book, Incendiary, The Psychiatrist, The Mad Bomber, and The Invention of Criminal Profiling. That grasps me right from the beginning. That's always been a fascinating aspect to me of how do all of these different developments in crime fighting start to evolve. What was the genesis point for them? How did they kick off? And our guest is here to talk about it. Michael Cannell, our guest. He was editor of the New York Times House and Home section for 7 years. He's written for The New Yorker, The New York Times Magazine, Sports Illustrated, and many other publications. Lives in New York City, and he's here with us this evening. Michael, thank you for joining us.
No, thanks for having me, Dave.
And don't worry, I've got I've got one of those Clorox wipes over my microphone, so I think you should be safe from my germs even at this distance.
Okay.
Let me get a little bit of your background. What about this case really kind of attracted your attention?
Well, I don't have a background in true crime or forensics. I come from a reporting background. My first job was writing obituaries for a small newspaper in Northern Virginia, and I worked for Time Magazine and then UPI, a wire service, and the New York Times. So I come from a reporting background, a news background. It's some years ago I transitioned from working on a newspaper to writing nonfiction books. And I try to write in a genre or a style known as narrative nonfiction. So what is narrative nonfiction? Narrative nonfiction is nonfiction, meaning it's all true, it's history, but it's written in the style of a novel. So we're talking about nonfiction, which borrows the techniques, the suspense, and the storytelling of a novel and applies it to nonfiction. The best examples that come to mind are probably Seabiscuit or Unbroken, with both of which were written by Laura Hillenbrand. And the books of the great Eric Larson, the most famous of which was called The Devil in the White City. And so I have spent the last, 10 years trying to write in this style. And my previous book was about two men on the Ferrari race team in the 1950s. And while I was working on that book, I was doing some research in the New York Public Library. I was reading microfilm, believe it or not. You probably haven't even thought about microfilm since you were in junior high school.
Yeah, exactly.
but I was reading a newspaper on microfilm, and I saw it was a 1957 newspaper, and there was a headline about the Mad Bomber, the so-called Mad Bomber of New York, and it just jumped out at me. And as strange, I don't normally say things like this, but I really had a kind of a hunch that was going to be my next book right then and there.
Well, yeah, that's certainly a sexy title to look at, right? The Mad Bomber of New York. I, again, having an interest in true crime and history, this was something that really kind of caught me off guard. I didn't realize this was taking place and for such a long period of time as well. When you started to dig into this story, were you surprised just how much information was available to you?
Yeah, I mean, I was. I mean, people haven't heard of the Mad Bomber. I mean, my mother remembers him because she lived in New York in the 1950s, but almost nobody remembers this story. And yet, you know, we tend to think that 9/11 was the beginning of terrorism in the United States. It's not really true. I think that you could plausibly say that this case of a serial bomber in New York was the first case of terrorism as we know it. as we experience it or think about it today. And this was a serial bomber who set off homemade bombs in public places in New York, 32 of them. He set them off in subway stations,
32.
Movie theaters, 32 bombs in public places, train stations, department stores, public libraries. And it wasn't the size of the bombs that created an atmosphere of terror. It was the randomness of the bombs. It was the suspense between in the weeks and sometimes months between the bombs going off, which greatly affected the mood of New York at that time. At its very worst, New Yorkers were scared to ride buses. They were scared to get on the subway. They were scared to go into stores, and they were particularly scared to go into movie theaters. He had really kind of brought New York City to its knees. And this is a time when New York was America at high tide. Most of the world's wealth at that time resided in America. And most of America's wealth resided in Manhattan. And so it was a time of a giddy time in New York. It was a time of incredible prosperity, with high rises going up, and Henry Luce, the publisher of Time magazine, was ordaining statesmen on the cover of Time magazine from his office in Midtown Manhattan, and the department store windows were filled with goods. But it was also a very dark time, and it was a dark time because it was the onset of the Cold War. But it was also a dark time because of this particular episode with this serial bomber that the police simply could not catch.
Now, with all of those bombs, was there any type of, and you said that there were quite long lags in between, were we certain that it was one person? Was there clues being left about, or letters and agendas being sent to the newspapers? How, when did they start to piece together that this was a serial situation?
Well, the bomber spree lasted, believe it or not, lasted 16 years. That's a little bit deceptive because he set off two bombs in 1940 and 41, and then there was a long lag period during the war. And so he didn't really get started in earnest until the mid-50s. And the bomber was a paranoid schizophrenic, and he had been injured in a furnace blast in a power plant operated by Con Edison, which is the utility company here in New York. And he never really received any compensation for his injury. So he had a legitimate workers' compensation issue. But what would have been just an ordinary, compensation issue, in his mind, because he was a paranoid schizophrenic, it inflated into a kind of grandiose campaign against not just Con Ed, but against all of the corporate and governmental forces that he believed were conspiring against him and lowly workers like himself. He assumed that the newspapers would take up his cause and that he would be treated as a great hero. When that did not happen, he ratcheted up his bombing campaign. He built bigger, more powerful bombs, and he began to place them with greater intent to maim and to kill, which for the most part meant placing them in crowded movie theaters where he knew that there would be a density of people in the dark. And all the while, he was writing letters to newspapers. In particular, he was writing letters to the New York Journal American, which is a now long-gone afternoon paper owned by the Hearst Corporation. And the publisher of the Journal American was a very interesting man named Seymour Bergson, who had been a war correspondent in the lead-up to World War II. And he had the idea that he would write a letter back to the bomber on the front page of the newspaper. And he did that on the day after Christmas, 1956. A letter appeared on the front page of the newspaper inviting the bomber to turn himself in. And lo and behold, the Journal American got a letter from the bomber a few days later. And so a kind of semi-secret correspondence developed between this mystery bomber and the publisher of this newspaper.
By the time he had written, he decided to take out this kind of formal plea in the newspaper, how many bombs had the bomber set off?
Oh, gosh, I can't give you the exact tally off the top of my head, but at that point it would have been, 20-something bombs.
And how many people had been murdered by his efforts by that point?
Unbelievably, he never murdered anyone.
Really?
He very, very seriously injured people, but he never actually killed anybody, which is a kind of miracle. But towards the end, the police knew that he was going to kill people and probably kill a lot of people. And so the police were just absolutely desperate to catch him before that happened.
Completely understandable. All right, so they decide to... I'm wondering, how did law enforcement take to this man reaching out, using the newspaper as a source to, kind of feed this fire and communicate with this killer or potential killer?
Yeah, it's a very interesting situation because, the newspapers were sort of the adversaries of the police, right? Police and newspapers have never cooperated. And yet, when the bomber began to write these letters, these kind of secret letters to the New York Journal American, the New York Journal American shared them with the police. And so Seymour Burks and the publisher of the newspaper and Stephen Kennedy, who was then the police commissioner, became these very, very unlikely allies. And they worked together to advance the manhunt. But even while that was happening, the reporters for the New York Journal American and the dozen other New York City newspapers were really holding the police's feet to the fire. They were, really holding the police to account for the fact that, years and years went by and they were not getting any closer to catching this serial bomber who was putting the public at such grave risk.
Now, when they were having this kind of secret dialogue, were they keeping it off the newspapers, or were they everyone once in a while publishing both sides of the conversation?
Well, it was more the latter than the former. The Journal American would publish some of the bomber's letters, but only parts that the police would allow them to publish, and usually with a kind of delay. And the Journal American would communicate with the bomber sometimes by placing little cryptic little messages in the classified section of their newspaper. They were kind of hidden little secret, almost coded messages to the bomber. And nobody really knew that this was going on until one day an editor at another newspaper noticed one of these little messages in the classified section and kind of figured out that the Journal American was corresponding, had this kind of this robust correspondence going with the bomber.
What kind of things were they exchanging in the classified section?
Well, the bomber believed, as I had said, the bomber believed that he was engaged in a kind of crusade, a moral crusade against corporate America. And so he was asking the Journal American to take up his cause for him and to be his mouthpiece. And the Journal American, for their part, were trying to get the bomber to turn himself in, and very specifically to turn himself in to the Journal American, because of course that would be the coup of all coups, to have the mystery bomber walk into their newsroom and surrender himself.
Would he ever get threatening that they would only print partial parts of his letters to them? Did he ever feel like they were baiting him and maybe they became endangered? I would guess employees would start getting real nervous, realizing, hey, we're in touch with this guy. If we start getting too close, we might be a target.
Well, it was a very tricky game that they were playing, because on the one hand, they were courting the mystery bomber. They were a little bit like hostage negotiators. They were trying to build trust with him. You know, they were trying to build a dialogue with him and get him to trust them. But at the same time, they were covering this ongoing story, and they were quoting all the things the police were saying about him, which, of course, would infuriate the bomber because he thought that he was this superhero. And he didn't enjoy hearing the police refer to him as a maniac and a crackpot and a public menace. So there were some instances when the bomber became disaffected because he was angry about what the Journal American was publishing about him elsewhere in the paper. But it's important to remember that this was the time. This is the late 50s. This is the moment when Americans began to watch the evening news. They began to watch Walter Cronkite. And so for the very, very first time, circulation and advertising was beginning to ebb away from newspapers and move to television. So this is that we talk about the decline of print. This is the very, very moment when print began its long decline. And Seymour Burks and the publisher of the Journal American had reason to believe that the Hearst Company was going to close his newspaper. And so what greater gift could there be to a newspaper publisher who was trying to keep their newspaper alive than this correspondence with the serial bomber? To Seymour Burks, it was a great gift and allowed him to boost the newspaper circulation at a time when he was desperately trying to make his newspaper a success.
Were there ever any allegations that maybe some of these letters were not legitimate and that they were nothing more than a desperate plea for this newspaper to try to stay alive and afloat and relevant?
Well, it's always true, as you and your constituents know, it's always true that when there is a crime of this sort, there are a great many copycats. And so in this period, the newsroom of the New York Journal American was flooded with letters, you know, most of which were not from the bomber. And so it was the job of the newspaper staff to try to determine which of these letters were legitimate and which were simply, you know, hoaxes. And that was a really big and difficult job to do that.
I would guess. How were they weeding through the false messages? I mean, obviously some had to be very easy to discern, but, you know, was there a lot of confusion, and are there any parts of the letters that they presented originally that we found out later are not really part of the canon or were written from somebody entirely different?
Well, there may have been some that were, I'm not aware of any, but there may have been some that were under consideration that were not legitimate. But over time, they began to see that the bomber's letters contained these very specific characteristics. He had very distinctive block handwriting. And some of the letters were written in a way that you really wouldn't, were really very unusual. And he used sort of funny, stilted phrases that weren't really the way, you know, native-born Americans would speak. And they also tended to be postmarked in Westchester, in the county that's just north of New York City. So over time, they could kind of figure out which were real and which weren't based on these characteristics.
With that said, did they start planting and having reporters or police stake out certain post offices or mailboxes in that area where these letters were being postmarked to see if they were able to figure out who this perpetrator might be?
Well, they absolutely did do that. And also in the latter part of his campaign, as I mentioned, the bomber was concentrating on movie theaters because he thought it's where he would most likely kill people. And the police planted plainclothes cops in all of the prominent New York City movie theaters, hoping and in train stations, hoping to catch a suspicious character in the act.
There had to be a pretty ample supply of possible suspects at the time. What were they doing to run through those? Or was there really no suspects? Nobody that stood out to them? Nobody that was being reported on by family members or friends as being, you know, possibly involved in this?
Well, they did have come up with a good number of suspects. They they began as they combed through these letters that the bomber sent to the Journal American. They, with each letter, they learned a little bit more about the bomber, and they began to zero in on a certain handful of suspects. Most of whom were turned in by acquaintances or former colleagues. In every one of those cases, the bomber, suspected, alleged bomber, had some disqualifying alibi. In every case, they appeared that the police had finally found their man, until they discovered that that person had been out of town for many of these episodes, or had, you know, in fact, had one, you know, one alibi after another. And so as the manhunt progressed, the police became more and more reluctant to commit themselves to suspects because they had embarrassed themselves in this kind of public manner, because this was such an enormous story that these false leads became kind of embarrassing episodes in the newspaper.
I would guess. Did they ever at any point end up crossing paths with this guy at one point and ended up accidentally clearing him?
No, they never did that. There were a couple of episodes where they felt like that people that they had spoken to had seen him, had spotted him. There was in one particular case in the New York City subway by Grand Central Station where a bomb had gone off, and they interviewed a bystander who appeared to have seen the bomber. And there would have been many instances when the bomber would have been leaving a movie theater, probably when the police came in. But there was never any real visual. They never actually saw the bomber until the arrest came.
Now, throughout this entire deal, you said we were lucky that murder hadn't actually occurred. There was some severe maiming and injuring, but the murders did not occur. How were people reacting out in the, you know, New Yorkers are pretty tough birds, right? I mean, this is something. I understand there was fear, but were they starting to try vigilante justice? Were people striking out to see if they could find who this nefarious criminal was on their own?
Well, not exactly. I mean, what happened is, we haven't had this part of the conversation, but what happened is the police went to us finally in desperation. The police did something they had never done before, and that is they went to see a psychiatrist. And the head of the bomb squad was a very highly educated man named Howard Finney. And he really felt like they were not going to catch this bomber unless they began to understand something about his inner life, his emotional life. What wrenching episodes in this figure's life would cause him to do this? So rather than just a profile of his appearance or an external profile, Howard Finney began to think about what an internal profile might be for the bomber. Psychiatrist did provide this, and at that point, the police began to publicize this profile, really the first case of criminal profiling. And when the public began to hear the description of the bomber, an enormous number of people called the police or contacted the police and said, "The man you're looking for is my neighbor," or, "The man you're looking for is my in-law," or in one case, a woman called the police and said, "The man you're looking for is my husband, come and take him away." So a lot of people, it was a little bit like a Rorschach test, I think. When people read this description of the bomber, they seemed to recognize in that description somebody quite close to him, to them.
That's boy, that's a tough deal. Yeah, my husband is the bomber. Come and get him, right?
Yeah.
Was that, I mean, was that pretty easily dismissed, or did she really believe she had a case against her husband?
Hard to know. I think she did. Like I say, I think it was like a Rorschach test. I think people read this description of the bomber, and it was like fortune telling. Maybe they kind of drew out of it what was familiar to them or what they wanted to. And kind of assigned it to their husband or their neighbor or their colleague.
And the violence around this, again, this kind of amping up and irritation that this guy would go through, what were the psychiatrists telling the police at that time about this guy? That you know, this was, as you said, kind of the beginning stages of criminal profiling.
Right. Well, I should back up and tell you that part of the story because it's really, I think, really interesting. So Howard Finney, the head of the bomb squad, decided he was going to go to a psychiatrist. And the psychiatrist he ended up consulting was a man named Dr. James Brussel, who was employed by the state of New York. His job was really to run the mental asylums in New York State. And so he'd seen a lot of the most violent and grisly human behavior, that behavior that psychiatrists don't normally see. Really, really grisly stuff. And Brussel himself was a real eccentric. He was kind of crazy himself. Like Sherlock Holmes, he was a drug addict and a kind of peculiar genius. And so Howard Finney, the head of the bomb squad, went to Dr. Brussel's office with two satchels of evidence. He emptied them on Dr. Brussel's desk. This is photographs of the bomb scenes. It's forensics of the bombs themselves. It's copies of the letters that the bomber sent to the New York Journal American. And Dr. Brussel went through this evidence for a couple of hours, 2 hours, and he made a lot of notes, and he thought about it, and in that same session, he turned to Howard Finney, and he said, "The man that you're looking for is from a Slavic background. He's never had a girlfriend. He lives with an older female relative. He has a history of workplace disputes, and the last thing he said was when you catch him, he'll be wearing a double-breasted jacket." Now, the police, two bomb squad detectives...
That's crazy specific.
Crazy specific.
Yeah.
Right? The two bomb squad detectives that accompanied Howard Finney to this appointment just laughed. I mean, they just rolled their eyeballs. They felt like they were wasting their time. But in fact, the police went to, just about exactly a month later, the police went to a bedraggled house on the side of a steep hill in Waterbury, Connecticut, at a midnight in January of 1957, and they knocked on the door. And a light came on, and a man came to the door in his pajamas, in a bathrobe. And that man was the bomber, and in fact, he fit Dr. Brussel's description pretty much exactly. Now, he wasn't wearing the double-breasted jacket because he was in his pajamas, but when the police said, "Go get dressed," sure enough, he came out of his bedroom with the double-breasted jacket on.
Holy cow. Now, that's
unbelievable.
Really,
it's unbelievable, and it's really how criminal profiling started. And, it didn't take long for police around the country to hear this story and to start calling Dr. Brussel, because they all had cold cases. They all had cases that they couldn't solve or hadn't been solved, or cases that, you know, were moldering away in a file that they had given up on. And Dr. Brussel worked on many of those cases and helped the police solve many of those cases, most famously the Boston Strangler case, and many other prominent cases. In fact, it wasn't very long before the FBI came to Dr. Brussel and said, "We would like to know how to do what you do." Well, and in fact, the FBI agent who came to Dr. Brussel's house said, we'll pay you your hourly rate, meaning his, you know, for his psychiatric practice. And Dr. Russell's response was, the FBI can't afford my hourly rate. I'll do it for free.
Wow, so he was willing to do it to help. That's great.
Yeah, he did it to help. And so that's how the FBI started doing profiling. Now, for those of you who watched the Netflix series Mindhunter,
right,
you watched a series in which it appears that the FBI invented criminal profiling on their own.
Right. I think John Douglas
really
is, yeah, John Douglas is kind of the first name most people think of when you come up with criminal profiling. But they've even proven in recent settings that true profiling is still not an art. You know, they can get some ideas, but it's not nearly as the, you know, fire starting, bed wetting, animal injuring, you must be a serial killer.
Yeah.
They've realized that they've been off base on a lot of that stuff as time kind of unfolds here. But with the case that, you know, that what they were going back on, what was so different about this doctor that he was so adept at looking at these crimes and figuring out what we would be looking for when it came to the killer?
Well, it was a couple of things. He had a theory that he could do what he called it reverse psychiatry. And the idea of reverse psychiatry is, let's say, his better-known, better-paid colleagues who were seeing patients in Manhattan. He lived in Queens, right? So he was not really in the center of things. He was a little bit obscure, kind of off the map. His more famous colleagues in the psychiatric field, they might see a patient. Let's say that patient's name was Joe. So they knew who Joe was. They were familiar with Joe. But what they didn't know was what Joe's behavior might be in the future. Let's say Joe was having marital problems, or Joe lost his job, or one of his parents died. The psychiatrist knew Joe, but they didn't know how Joe was going to react to these things that might happen to him in the future. Dr. Brussels' great idea was that you could do this in reverse. In other words, what if you didn't know who Joe was, but you knew Joe's behavior? Then you could let Joe's behavior define who Joe was. So that was the fundamental idea that profiling started with, was Dr. Brussels' idea. You know, we don't know who the mystery bomber is, but we do know his behavior. So can we let his behavior define what the personality is? And that was the idea that Dr. Brussels started with. And he also had this idea, which was kind of unusual at the time, which was, you know, the police all believed that somebody who was crazy was just crazy. They were just insane. They didn't have any logic. Dr. Brussels' belief was a paranoid schizophrenic does have logic. It's just not logic that we understand. And so part of the great leap that he made was to try to get inside the bomber's head and try to understand what the bomber's logic was. And it kind of helped Dr. Brussels that he was kind of crazy himself, and he knew it. And so he kind of was sympathetic to this idea that people who might be simply labeled insane, in fact, had a kind of internal logic. And the key to profiling, as we now call it, was to just kind of decode what that logic was.
That must be an amazing talent, right? To kind of look at that. Look at just the actions, the outside actions of someone like this, and start to be able to kind of backwards, you know, it's like my dad taught me when building a puzzle, you start with the frame and then build your way in. And that's what it seems
what
like criminal profiling
reverse
is.
Engineering.
Right,
it's
right.
Reverse engineering in a way. And then there's another part to this, which I think is so interesting. That is that when the FBI started to develop criminal profiling, they really wanted to think of it as a science. And it is kind of a science, right? It's about data and behavior. But Dr. Brussels didn't really think of it that way. He believed in the power of intuition. He thought his own subconscious could figure out who the bomber was more effectively than his conscious mind could. And so part of what profiling was for him was to look at all the evidence, and then he would just really kind of close his eyes and just try to conjure who this bomber was, in really almost in a kind of mystical way. This vision of these criminal offenders would come to his mind. I think that J. Edgar Hoover did not like the idea of the FBI being associated with anything as flaky as, you know, intuition. And so when the FBI developed profiling, they really treated it as if it were a hard science.
Oh, so they got rid of kind of the woo-woo factor.
Exactly.
Or at least they didn't acknowledge that they were using the woo-woo factor. They were just giving you the hard science of what they were looking for.
Yes, but if you talk to profilers today, they will acknowledge that intuition is a big part of what they do.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah, law enforcement. I mean, I know plenty of law enforcement officials. That's what they say. That's what saved their life on many occasions, knowing when to duck when they shouldn't have.
Right.
So here they finally capture this bomber. They go. And how strange is that, right? You go in and you're like, hey, we need to take you in, and you just let him go into his room and get dressed. You would think that'd be the last guy you'd want going into another room, because how do you know he's not going to blow that whole place to kingdom come?
Well, of course, they were very careful. They were very careful about this, and they had men stationed all around the back of the house in case he tried to escape. And then they took him in for interrogation, and then they were very careful about going back to the house to look for additional evidence. They were understandably concerned that he may have booby-trapped the house.
Sure. So once they've got him, do they explain to him when they first show up why they're there?
Yeah.
And
well, they got a warrant to go to his house in the middle of the night. And what they told the man, whose name was George Metesky, was his name, they told him that they were there to investigate a traffic accident. But it didn't take very long, if any time at all, for George Metesky to know why they were there. And in fact, I think he may have been more or less waiting for that knock on the door.
And once they bring him in, how easy is he to crack? Does he roll right over and give himself up, or does he play hard to get for a while?
Well, not only does he roll right over, but he enthusiastically, even gleefully, recounts all of these bombing episodes, and he recounts them with an unbelievable grasp and memory for the details of these circumstances. He was the most cooperative suspect the police have ever had. And part of that sort of fits with the paranoid schizophrenic personality. He believed that he was engaged in this moral campaign, as I've said before, and that there was something kind of godlike in his behavior. He believed that he was a kind of superior being, almost godlike. And so if you were godlike, you would want people to know it. And what's the point of being godlike if nobody knows who you are?
Well, do you think he was going with the God complex, or do you think it was more along the lines that he sounded very Robin Hood-esque to me, right? He was trying to kind of stand up for the everyman, and he was not going to let these organizations and these corporations and these corrupt businesses continue to do this. So that's why he thought that the newspapers would rally. He thought he was really kind of the hero behind the story, right?
Well, yeah, I think it's both. He thought that he was a hero, but he thought that he was almost like a superhero. He sort of thought that he was like Superman and that he had special powers and that he was he had greater moral rectitude than normal people did. And that he was going to make the world right, and he was going to vanquish evil. And if you're vanquishing evil, you kind of want to have you want people to know that you're a hero, right? So he was very happy to share all this with the police. And then when the police took him down to New York City from Waterbury, Connecticut, to take him in for booking at the old police headquarters downtown, and there was a huge, vast crowd of reporters and photographers gathered around for him to do his perp walk, he strutted up and down the sidewalk as if he were, you know, on the red carpet at the Oscars, beaming and happy looking. And so he was enjoying. No suspect has ever enjoyed being taken in for booking more than he did.
But he thought, do you think this was, now I'm going to be vindicated, now the people are going to see me, they're going to hear my story and know what a good thing I've done?
I don't know if it was that logical. I think it was more like he believed that he was a hero and he was getting a hero's recognition or welcome. I think he really thought that this was his parade, almost like a hero's parade.
Now they've got him in. He gives up everything in frighteningly accurate detail. So we know we have our perpetrator. Are there, you mentioned this earlier, are there copycats taking up his, his legacy that thought, well, you know what, I like what he thought, I'm going to do that now.
Yeah, I mean, mostly that was happening before he was arrested, when the so-called Mad Bomber of New York was all over the headlines. The bomb squad was forced to traverse the city 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, chasing down these hoaxes and false leads. And I think that on the greatest number of bomb scares in a single day, it was like something like 50 bomb scares in a single day. And so the bomb squad had barely had any time to really concentrate on the actual perpetrator, because they were racing from Flushing to Bensonhurst, chasing down one hoax after another. Now, some of these were very deliberately planted as hoaxes, and some were just simply, boxes at the post office that had a toy inside that was making a clicking device, that kind of thing. Some of them were very intentionally placed in imitation of the bomber, and some were just, unintentionally suspicious packages.
And how long does this whole court case take place? I've got to guess you've got this guy dead to rights with his own admissions. This has got to be a cut and dry, in and out, 24-hour day case. Well, how did that go down?
Well, I had not really fully appreciated this when I started to work on this book. But in a way, the bomber's arrest was only the beginning of the story. Now, it was very clear that he was a paranoid schizophrenic. It was very clear that he was mentally ill. We would expect somebody like that to be excused from trial as mentally incompetent. We might expect them to be sent to a hospital for the criminally insane, a facility that was, kind of half jail, half hospital. But something very unusual happened, and that is that George Metesky, the Mad Bomber, landed right in the middle of a fight that was going on between the judiciary and the psychiatric field. The judges at the time wanted there to be a clear-cut definition of insanity. They wanted it to be like you were either insane or you weren't. Psychiatrists didn't really think that way. And in fact, psychiatrists, interestingly, did not even use the term insane. That was really just a legal term. And so a panel of five psychiatrists were assigned to evaluate the bomber. And they all ruled that he was mentally incompetent. But the judge in the case, who was in a kind of old-style judge appointed by Tammany Hall, he did not want the psychiatrist to tell him what to do. And he rejected their evaluation. And he wanted the Mad Bomber to go to trial. He was trying to make a point, which is the psychiatrists are not going to let this guy off. And he would have gone to trial, except that the furnace blast at the Con Edison plant that had taken place 20 years earlier, which set this entire story in motion, had caused George Metesky, the Mad Bomber, to have tuberculosis. And just as he was about to go to trial, he hemorrhaged and he began to bleed in his lungs. And it became clear that he wouldn't live through a trial, not to mention that he was contagious. And so a kind of legal mechanism, which I won't bore you with, was enacted, and he was shuffled out of the city and sent to a hospital for the criminally insane, where he was expected to die within 2 weeks or even 10 days. In fact, he didn't die. He got better. And one of the ironies of the story is that he outlived absolutely everybody else in the story and lived to be released and went back to Waterbury, Connecticut, and lived a very, very long old age.
Really? How bizarre. Now, the fact, though, and where do you stand on this? I mean, I think it's interesting that the judge was kind of putting his foot down to say, hey, listen, you know, he was, we can't let psychiatry completely overrule the fact that we need justice. The guy made bombs for a number of years, specifically and methodically picked out locations to plant the bombs, taunted people through newspaper letters. So there was some schizophrenia and issues, but there still has to be a line of culpability. And it sounds like because he was able to still function and live a normal daily life and continue this, it wasn't just once in a blue moon. I mean, he continued this journey for a long time. That would bring us out of the line of complete mental incompetence. He does understand good and bad and right and wrong, and that's the importance of trying to seek justice, isn't it?
Well, what happened is, I mean, I'm not sure if I'm really exactly responding to your question, but what happened was that what preceded George Metesky's arrest was a couple of high-profile cases in which really sick killers had been released from prisons. Like, the psychiatric panels had deemed them to be no longer a threat, and they had been released back into the populace and committed other crimes. And, of course, this caused an uproar. And for those judges who were not inclined to cede any authority to the psychiatrists, they took that as vindication of their point of view. Their stance was essentially, see, this is why we shouldn't let the psychiatrists make these determinations. And so when Metesky was arrested, this judge, he was making a determination that wasn't just about Metesky, but it was really about the cases that had come before it. He was reacting to these other cases in which psychiatrists had perhaps erred in their evaluation of inmates. And this judge, who was a tough old guy named Don Mullen, he was going to make an example of Metesky. He was going to force Metesky to go to trial because he was really trying to kind of wrest control away from the psychiatrists and bring it back into the judge's hands.
All right. This kind of crime, and now that they've kind of looked at this, looked at the value of who this person was, why he was doing this crime, and kind of the beginnings, the awakenings of criminal profiling, how does that start to impact history going down with this? I mean, obviously, there are you had the Ted Kaczynskis and more that were very good at continuing to stay ahead of law enforcement for many years doing heinous crimes like this.
Well, I mean, a couple of thoughts about that. It's a very interesting question. Number one is, at this time, and we're talking about the 1950s, of course there had been serial killers, serial offenders, and serial rapists before. I mean, Jack the Ripper was a serial killer. But there hadn't been that many of them. And so this marks the beginning of a period in which this kind of crime, the serial crime perpetrated by a mentally ill offender, was on the rise. Now, why is that? I don't know that anybody has ever really answered that question. Maybe it has to do with the graphic violence on television and movies. Maybe it has to do with the alienation of society that began in the 1950s, or the way in which people were mobile in their lives in a way that they weren't before. Who knows? Very hard to say. But this case, the case of the Mad Bomber, kind of is the first chapter in a series of these kinds of very high, you know, very public cases involving a serial offender. The Boston Strangler, of course, came, you know, some 6 years later. And so the police at this time were trying to grapple with the question of how they were going to handle these cases. It was a new kind of crime, and they needed a new tool to solve it, and profiling was that tool. Now, you mentioned Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber. He, in a way, he was very similar to the serial bomber, but he also was very aware of the Metesky case, of the Mad Bomber of New York, and may well have kind of patterned himself after George Metesky.
Where was George getting all of the equipment to create these bombs?
Well, he had been in the Marines, and he had been assigned to as an ordnance chief in the Marines. So he was well acquainted with explosives. He had mechanical aptitude, but he made these bombs in a garage behind his home in Waterbury, Connecticut, a home that he shared with his two older sisters. And he made the bombs from just very ordinary parts that he bought at, you know, hardware stores.
How did his sisters respond to that, when they realized that he was the bomber living under their roof?
Well, of course, they adamantly refused to believe it at first, but then later grudgingly acknowledged that they knew that their brother had some very serious problems. I don't think they quite understood how serious his problems were, but it was probably a case of denial. I mean, they must have known that something was going on with him, because he would get in the car and disappear for long periods of time under sort of mysterious circumstances. And in fact, you know, of course, what he was doing was driving into New York and planting these bombs and then driving back.
Was he ever nearly caught? Was he ever nearly caught during this run?
Yes, there was a case when a bomb that he had planted in Radio City Music Hall went off prematurely. Well, normally what he would do is he would go when he was in the latter phase of his bombing campaign. He was bombing in movie theaters mostly, as I mentioned earlier. He would buy a ticket to a late afternoon and early evening show. He would walk into the theater with this pipe bomb in his coat pocket, and he would sit in the back half of the orchestra. When the lights came down, he would take a cheap pocket knife out of his pocket, and he would rip open the upholstery of the adjacent seat. He would shove the bomb into the upholstery, and then he would shove the pocket knife in with it. And then he would leave the theater as if he were going to get popcorn or go to the men's room or something. And in this case, in this one instance, the bomb went off just as he was leaving the auditorium, and an usher grabbed him. And the bomber, he later described to the police that he thought he had been finally caught. In fact, the usher was just grabbing him to apologize to him and said, "I'm sorry that this incident has occurred. I'd like to give you a free pass to come back. I promise you that this won't happen if you come back." And the bomber thought to himself, "I promise you, if I come back, this will happen again."
Oh, jeez. What was the turning point again? And I'm sorry, I know you mentioned it. I'm fighting the man flu here, so my head is cloudy through some of this. But again, what was the one aha moment that brought the police department to his door?
Well, what happened is I described earlier how the bomber was writing letters to the New York Journal American, and with each letter, the New York Journal American, and by extension the police, learned a little bit more about the bomber. At the same time, the police had this profile, the first ever profile, written by Dr. James Brussel, and they put these two things together, and they could begin to see some, you know, beginning to be fairly accurate description of who this person might be. They had figured out by now he had worked for Con Ed. And so they began to go through the old Con Ed files looking for former employees who had left under some disgrace or under some rancorous conditions. They begin to look through those files, you know, the problem files, and they begin to look through those files looking for people who fit Dr. Brussel's description. And what the police did not know was that Con Ed was hiding files from them, and Con Ed was going through the files on their own without telling the police. And eventually, the Journal American wrote the bomber a letter and asked him when this incident, he was talking about this incident that had happened with Con Ed, when did this happen? And the bomber wrote back and gave them the date. And then when they had the date, then they could really begin to narrow the number of files down, because they had the date. They could see what incidences occurred on that date in the files. And then also kind of correlate that with what Dr. Brussel had told them about who this bomber might be. And so they settled on this one file, and that's when they went to Waterbury, Connecticut, and found him.
Con Ed was actually keeping files from the police and internal investigation in on some of this stuff?
They were. And the reason that they were is that this was a period when they were beginning to build power plants and to fill those power plants with what we now would recognize to be toxic chemicals like asbestos and other materials. And Con Ed knew that a lot of their employees were getting sick, and they were not anxious for the police to know this and not anxious for the public to know this.
Was there any kind of legal action then held towards Con Ed for kind of impeding the process of the legal system?
Well, as you can imagine, the detectives were furious. I'm not aware that there was any legal action involved. There was a very, very heated meeting between Stephen Kennedy, who was the police commissioner, and the head of Con Ed. And it's complicated by the fact that the police originally claimed to have found the file. In fact, a Con Ed clerk found the file. And, of course, all this was playing out in the newspapers, you know, on the front page of the newspapers. So it was a really embarrassing episode for the police and a really embarrassing episode for Con Ed.
Wow, I would guess so. That's just unbelievable. What a fascinating story. And as you're watching this and kind of going through the annals of time to watch this whole story unfold, what is that like for you? I mean, as somebody, you know, not really a true crime author or researcher, this had to be a really amazing tale to be your first.
Well, of course, it's a fantastic story, and I could recognize that. You know, if you write nonfiction books like I do, people are always telling you, you should write about this. This is really interesting. And it is really interesting. But a book needs a kind of narrative. It needs a very particular architecture. It needs to have a certain quality and a certain kind of structure. And when I began to read about this story initially after I saw those headlines about it that I mentioned, it didn't take me very long to figure out that this had the, you know, it had the structure and the architecture of a book. And you know, I think people shouldn't write, they shouldn't write books unless they're obsessed with the subject matter.
Right.
And it was very, very easy to become obsessed with this subject matter.
Oh, I can only guess. Did that set new precedents in the way that investigations would be handled going forward, and any other new laws or anything that came into effect because of that case?
Well, the thing that comes to mind is that I haven't really said this, but touched on this yet, but you know, the police at this time is the 1950s. 1950s was a period when science was changing the way Americans lived or thought about the world in all sorts of ways. You know, medical science was making great leaps forward. Jonas Salk found the polio vaccine, and you know, aeronautics was, you know, starting to gain momentum. And but the one area where science didn't seem to make any inroads was in police work, and I think that's because the policemen were, for the most part, in New York anyway, they were guys who didn't barely graduated from high school. They were not that different from the criminals or thugs that they were chasing, except they happened to have the blue uniforms on. They were neighborhood guys. They were tough guys. And they solved crimes by roughing up suspects and leaning on informants. And they just simply did not believe that science could help them. They did not see a way in which somebody with a college degree, let alone a graduate school degree, could help them to solve crimes. And that was the real break from the past in this case. One of the things that really changed was that the police had gone to a doctor, had gone to a psychiatrist. And so that changed, it changed police work. It was sort of the introduction of scientific techniques. Believe it or not, Howard Finney, who was the head of the bomb squad, was also head of the crime lab, and even the forensics lab was kind of, you know, a little bit on the periphery of the police department in those days. They were still not really central to police work. And so with the success of this manhunt, that began to change.
All right, and I know we're running out of time here together. What do you really hope people get from this type of book and the, you know, kind of interesting insights into a time and part of our history that most people forgot even existed?
Well, in the introduction or the prologue to this book, I end it by saying that what I learned from writing this book is that to write a book about madness is really to write a book about yourself. I forget what my exact words were, but that's essentially it. And, of course, when I've done speaking engagements, people always ask me about that. I've never had any episodes of mental illness that I'm aware of. But what I've come to understand is that the mad bomber is not that different from you and me. You know, this old-fashioned idea that you're either insane or you aren't, in the same way that you might either have hepatitis or you don't have hepatitis, it isn't really true. We're all on a spectrum. We're all a little bit crazy. And we all have some kind of mental illness around us, whether we're aware of it or not, in our families, among our friends, among our coworkers. And so the old-fashioned idea that madness is sort of the other, that it's something, you know, on the other side of some barrier. We're not crazy, but those people might be. It isn't really true. Any of us could have been the mad bomber. And so that, I think that's how I'm going to try to answer that question, by saying that one of the lessons of profiling is that our psyches are very fragile, and you know, the bomber had his own logic, just as we have logic, but the bomber had his own logic, and so he's not that different from us.
Well, speak for yourself, Michael. He's a lot different than me. But now that I know you don't feel that different from him, I will let Homeland Security know that they should keep an eye on you.
Okay. Yeah.
Michael, thank you so much for sharing this very interesting part of our history, and what a crazy time and part of history to be alive. I'm just curious on the way out. How did they speak to anybody in his military background that said that, yeah, this guy was a nut from the get-go? Or was he, as you said, it could be just anyone. Was he somebody that fit in and did well in the service?
Yeah, he did two tours of duty, so I think he did pretty well, and he was promoted a couple of times. I don't think that they spoke to anybody from his military background. However, they did take the bombs, the bomb parts, and show them to bomb technicians in the military, because they did. They had a theory that he might have learned these bomb techniques while serving abroad. And that didn't really pan out, but they had an idea that he might have learned how to make bombs while he was stationed overseas.
Wow. Interesting stuff. Michael Cannell, thank you so much. And we'll put up a link to the book and a link to your website so people can follow it and pick up a copy of the book. Again, great interview, lots of information, but this is a 376-page book, folks. There's a lot that we only brush the surface of. And you have to see the way this case deconstructs itself and the way these people are able to put together this upside-down, backwards puzzle. It's a fantastic story. And in the narrative writing technique, much like In Cold Blood, I think, as well, is another very famous one that kind of set the precedent for that narrative. Check it out for yourself. All right, speaking of checking out strange narratives, Tim, my friend, it's time to take a look at dumb crimes and stupid criminals. Bradford County, Florida. That's the first stop on our luxury journey today, Tim. Two arrests have been made in connection with a series of thefts from cemeteries. Officials with the Bradford County Sheriff's Office said Monday night. Deputies captured 34-year-old Jenny Hudkins, the woman they refer to as the Gravesite Grinch, on Christmas morning. Hudkins is accused of stealing hundreds of dollars worth of Christmas decorations and memorabilia from grave sites. Now, normally, Tim, you know, I've tried to stray away from mocking people's looks because, again, you can't always... You know, you look the way you look, and you can't really blame somebody for that.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not fair. We've had people put us in our place, and I've realized that there is there's something to that. But I've just sent you the link for this news story. And I want you to tell me that the Gravesite Grinch does not live up to her name.
All right. Let's take a look at this here. Let's see.
Jenny Hudkins is the one on your left. And Janice Crawford on the right, but Jenny is she looks like the human version of the Grinch. It's uncanny. Deputies also arrested Janice Crawford on Saturday on a charge of dealing in stolen property. As members of the Wheeler family put their son Connor's grave back together, they're relieved to know that the woman accused of being the Gravesite Grinch is now behind bars. If she's from this town, she should have known better because she messed with the wrong people. She messed with the wrong town. The wrong law enforcement officer. Stupid girl, Kim Wheeler said. The Gravesite Grinch thefts have been the talk of the town for the past week. One affected relative said, learning of the arrests is the best news she's heard all Christmas. Crawford, who is related to Wheeler family, was accused of buying the stolen property from Hudkins for her thrift store. But she said she had no idea that the items were stolen. Deputy said Hudkins stole hundreds of dollars in Christmas decorations and memorabilia from three different grave sites this month. Hundreds of dollars in decorations from three grave sites. Holy cow. Investigators found Hudkins hiding in a wooded area in Lottie. Of course, where else are you going to find the Grinch? I said, Jenny, where did this stuff come from? Crawford said. She never told me it came from the graveyard. When asked where exactly she had the items or had gotten the items and where they originated, Crawford just answered that it was hers and her mom's and that she's had some of it in storage. Now, deputies said that Crawford failed to call authorities after learning the items were stolen. Detectives claim a source told them Crawford had been hiding the stolen items at her house. But Crawford told News 4 Jax, that's not true. I was scared, Crawford said. I was literally scared out of my mind. She said she feels terrible for what happened. I'm sorry. I'm so, so sorry, Crawford said. I wish I could undo that little bit of buying that I had done. Although the Wheelers are glad to know their son's grave is safe, they want to make sure the so-called graveside Grinch pays the price for stealing from the dead. Hudkin's first appearance in court will be Tuesday. The Wheeler family said they plan on attending. Hudkins is accused of stealing from gravesites in Crosby Lake, Connor, and Brown cemeteries, investigators said. A warrant had been issued for her arrest late last week. This is all you have left of them, and you want to decorate it, and all you have is this, for people to come see you, and people rob you, Wheeler said. You feel like you just lose them again. It just tears you up. Hudkins' bond has been set at $100,000, while Crawford's was set at just $25,000. Crawford bailed out at the Bradford County Jail. At last check, detectives said the stolen items have been returned to their owners, but they added that they don't believe Hudkins was working alone. So more arrests could be made, Tim. Are they going to find Max the dog?
It's disturbing and sad all in the same vein. Stealing from a graveyard.
Yeah, I wonder if she was thinking it's a victimless crime. These people are not going to enjoy it. You know, it's I need to pay my bills and feed my family. You just wonder what the real story is, and that's the sad part. Because it's real easy, as it's happening in Florida, to just roll your eyes and say, oh, you crazy Floridians. But we don't know what the story is.
With the older generation, though, I mean, they really do the upkeep on graves, and they really do go out there on a regular basis. Not so much the younger generation, but the older generation does. So I don't know that you could say it's a victimless crime. You know, look at me bringing the room down. But
just wondering if that's what her mindset might have been, is that it was a victimless crime.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Probably. It probably was, yeah.
Yeah, here's a genius for you, Tim. This guy straight out of Sacramento, California. A California man is behind bars after officers said he took a Sacramento police cruiser for a joyride. I guess if you're going to go in style. Go with a smile, right? If you're going to go out for a joyride and you're going to steal a car, that's the one to do it. Because, first of all, it's got to give you quite the sense of accomplishment. And just let me stop right now and say, this doesn't mean that Tim and I endorse that if you're thinking about going for a joyride, you steal a cop car.
Right.
No, we're not saying that, but I'm just saying, you know, this guy, he went balls to the wall on this, Tim. Part of the wild joyride was caught on camera by a good Samaritan, Chris Marzen. Marzen thought something might be wrong, so he tailed the reckless driver. He followed the driver to a gas station where he got out and made a citizen's arrest and waited for police to arrive. Citizen's arrest? Citizen's arrest, Barney? How the hell do you do a citizen's arrest in 2018 and not have somebody just punch you in the nose and take off? Marzen said it was a wild night he won't forget. I noticed it was a Sacramento police vehicle. As I passed, he makes a U-turn, so in my mind, I'm like, great, I'm going to get pulled over, Marzen said. I then saw an individual, a male, get out of the vehicle wearing gray sweats and a black shirt. And I'm like, that's definitely not an officer. Police say an officer had stepped out of the patrol car that was stolen to respond to a call for service. The suspect, Zachary Samaha, faces a felony charge for stealing a patrol car and a misdemeanor for driving under the influence. How is that a misdemeanor? Isn't it a felony to drive under the influence of alcohol?
I thought it was.
Wow. Maybe they want that. Maybe it's like the heavier penalty. It's like football, offsetting penalties. We don't want to give them two felonies because we're not going to keep them both sticking. So we make one a felony, one a misdemeanor, and we have some room to play. I don't know. I don't recommend anyone doing what I did, Marzen said. I stand by my decision because I can't live with myself if something had happened to someone. Sacramento police say they're investigating the incident and hope to prevent another patrol car from ever being stolen again. How rough is that cop's life that got his patrol car stolen, do you think? Do you think they're messing with him?
Oh, my God, are they ever?
Yeah.
He's got to be the laughing stock of his unit, that's for sure. I mean, that sounds like a great album name, too. But
Laughing stock of the unit?
The laughing stock of my unit, yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, as long as we're talking dumbasses and police cars, Tim, a Danish drug dealer has been arrested carrying 1,000 cannabis joints after getting into a police car he thought was a taxi, Tim. It's hard to tell nowadays, you know? These Ubers, these cabs, these cop cars are so similar. A drug dealer in Denmark is facing prison after getting into a police car with 1,000 joints, thinking the vehicle was a taxi. According to police in Copenhagen, I'm sorry, it's Copenhagen. I learned the right way. Copenhagen, the man was in the city's alternative enclave of Christian. Oh, God, and this is where I'm going to botch it, right? I learned Copenhagen, and I can't say Christianania. How, what the hell is this word? And was in such a hurry to get home, he hopped into a police car after mistaking it for a taxi. He was searched by an officer who found him to be carrying 1,000 joints. Copenhagen police wrote on Twitter, the local.dk reported. Last night, a cannabis dealer from Christiania, who wanted to get wanted to get home quickly, got into a taxi. He received a big surprise when he realized it was actually a police car he was sitting in, police wrote. The police officers were happy to see him since he was carrying 1,000 joints. I'd be happy to see him if he wanted a ride with 1,000 joints, Tim.
I think at least 2,000 people would be happy to see him, Dave.
Yeah. The force then tweeted a second time to say that the man could face a custodial sentence for the offense. The arrest came after Copenhagen police increased their presence in Christiania, which was originally set up by hippie squatters back in 1971, Tim. Police have carried out several raids and used drones in a clampdown on narcotics in the area. If it's weed, do you really need drones? Don't you just need to walk in with a couple of tacos? Don't they come crawling out like cockroaches in an apartment in New York City?
Just bring one large pizza, you'll get them all.
Like a chalupa.
Oh.
Right? The magic of the chalupa. All right. Let's see what else here. Last year, two men in Rexburg, Idaho, carrying more than 20 pounds of pot in their car, gave themselves up to police officers after mistakenly believing they were being tailed by a patrol car. We reported that. And in 2009, a 19-year-old drug dealer decided to sell weed by going door-to-door in Brownsville, Texas. But one of his clients turned out to be an off-duty police officer. That was another case of swift justice, swift justice, swift justice! It's a good one, Tim.
That's, I've been upping the effects budgets.
Obviously. Week by week. Do you ever drink Stella?
She doesn't come around as often as she used to, Dave.
No, you don't like Stella? See, I don't like Stella. I don't like some of those kind of pints, so, you know, I don't know. And, when I drank them, I just got thick headaches. I didn't feel right, so I kind of understand this guy. All right, how many pints of Stella would it take you to drink, Tim, before you would start biting security guards' legs? It's a question that you probably never thought you'd ever be asked, Tim. But, well, here we are on Dumb Criminals and Stupid Crimes, or Stupid Criminals and Dumb Crimes, or whatever the hell this show is called. How many pints, Tim? A one, a two, a three. Three. How many would it take for you before you just decide to bite a security guard in the leg?
I think I got to be like at least 7 to 8 in before I start biting.
Right, 7 to 8. And 7 to 8 pints of Stella, that's some heavy liquor right there.
Right.
Booze. Yeah. Well, not liquor, but you know what I'm saying, alcohol.
Yeah.
All right, are you ready for this?
Okay.
Anthony Anderson, age 43, claimed he was standing up for a friend on the bus who was being picked on, but his confrontation with the driver led him to being spoken to by security guards at Hull Paragon Interchange. Hull Magistrates Court heard how Anderson became aggressive and squared up to the complainant, who was joined by a colleague trying to remove him. But the situation escalated, prosecutor Colette Dixon said, and the pair ended up wrestling on the ground, where Anderson bit him on the leg and punched him in the face after having drank 20 pints of Stella.
Oh,
Stella! 20 pints of Stella, Tim. How would you just not be peeing everywhere?
No, I know.
Am I that old? I drink 6 and I go to the bathroom for like 4 hours straight. 6 beers, I pee all the time. This guy put 20 pints of Stella into his system.
Maybe he's got the old colostomy bag, but he's got the catheter running in.
And I don't know.
He's got like the saddlebag attached.
The victim managed to radio British Transport Police, who came and arrested Anderson. The guard suffered a bruised and swollen lip and red marks and bruises on his leg, where he had been bitten, Mrs. Dixon said, to which Anderson sat shaking his head at the back of the court. Anderson of Rothschild Avenue, West Hull, was searched and found in possession of a small amount of herbal cannabis, which was accepted for his personal use. In police interview on May 21st last year, the day after the incident, Anderson said he had been drinking all day with a friend. Mrs. Dixon said he said he'd drunk 20 pints of Stella because he'd had some bad family news, and that's why he was drinking. He did accept that there was an altercation on the bus with another male. Asked about the shouting and swearing when he got off the bus, Anderson said he felt intimidated by the security guards and said they'd sworn at him, which he didn't think was reasonable. And that made him angry, Tim. That made him very, very angry. Anderson said he tried to bite the security guard because he was frightened. What is he, a chihuahua? Also claimed...
A rhesus monkey?
He also claimed he had been punched in the face and stomach while on the ground. He admitted assault by beating and possessing cannabis. Wait a minute. Is it assault just by possessing cannabis? He admitted assault by beating and possessing cannabis. Robin Smith for Anderson said, I accept this was an unpleasant incident and one where the security officer was injured. He apologizes for his behavior on that particular evening. He was heavily in drink. Is that what they call it? In drink? He was trying to assist a friend of his who was being picked on the bus, and he just let the temper get the best of him. Anderson received an 8-week prison sentence, suspended for 12 months, was ordered to do 50 hours of unpaid work and pay $100 compensation as well as $85 in court costs and $105 surcharge. Wow, your court cost was $85. The surcharge was $105, Tim.
It's those hidden fees that always get you, Dave.
It wraps up by saying, the money will be deducted from his benefits at £10 a fortnight.
£10 a fortnight.
Yeah. I don't know what that even means. I think they're just making up words again.
Yeah, I think so.
Here's a...
£10.
This is the story that could put me over, Tim.
Okay.
I'm giddy. I'm doped up on NyQuil, trying to get through just another day.
Mm-hmm.
And this is my headline. Driver refuses. All right. Driver refuses to... Oh, this is going to get me, Tim Dennis. I should have just sent this story to you. You're not as goofy as I am. Driver refuses to unclench his heroin-hiding buttocks. That's the headline for this story, Tim. After several attempts, deputies... deputies managed to pry the drugs out of his butt. Man, you got to really want something to just have to pry it out of somebody's butt. Oh, God. We're going to Oxalusa Island. A 37-year-old man was arrested after he tried to hide a bag of heroin between his buttocks during a traffic stop. The Niceville man was refused to unclench his buttocks. For Oxalusa County Sheriff's deputies to retrieve the drugs. After several attempts, they managed to pry the drugs out of his butt. This guy has just made a career on strengthening your core and your buttocks muscles, Tim. He's going to create a video. Because if it takes multiple police officers to pull your ass cheeks apart to get out a bag of heroin, you are... Your ass is the Tony Stark iron butt of America right there.
He took buns of steel one too many places, yeah.
Oh, no. Here we go. After several attempts, they managed to pry the drugs out of his butt. When he stood up, a syringe fell to the ground, according to the arrest report.
Oh,
that's where that was.
He didn't really. That's what he said.
Oh, how do you put it? No. Oh. I can understand putting a packet up there. But you think you're going to hide a needle? And a syringe in your butt?
Well.
Oh, my God.
Cavernous.
I don't need to know that much about your butt, Tim.
Well, I'm not saying it. Me, it's
good cover. Good cover. When he stood up, a used syringe fell to the ground, according to the arrest report.
A used one?
Oh, that's where it's been. I've been looking for that. Okay, could you take a peek up there and see if me remote controls are too? I've been watching the stupid Discovery Channel for a month and a half. The deputy said he could see the man making a lot of furtive movements as he approached the car. A search of the vehicle revealed a metal spoon with burn marks. Did you sniff them to make sure they were burn marks?
Oh, no.
He had an active warrant for his arrest on 3 counts of dealing in stolen property. He was charged with possession of drugs and paraphernalia, as well as tampering with evidence. Tampering with evidence is what they're calling it nowadays, Tim. You kegel that ass cheek tight and hold that heroin in and you're tampering with evidence.
You suppose the instrument they used to get all this out was called the Jaws of Strife?
Oh, good God.
Yeah.
Oh, hold on. I need a break. All right. We're back. Now, I thought that story was dumb, but the Pennsylvania Real-Time News delivers me this headline.
The Pennsylvania Real-Time News?
Yes, sir. PennLive.com. Man with green tongue can't beat conviction for driving under the influence of the devil's lettuce, Tim. A motorist whose tongue was green when a state trooper pulled him over has failed to beat his conviction for driving under the influence of marijuana. Does it really turn your tongue green?
No, that's why I'm... Why did he have a green tongue?
Maybe he had one of those edibles, like those lollipops or something, and it turned his tongue green. Maybe that's the deal. Shall we read, or should we just pontificate on all the different things that could have caused his tongue to go green?
I say we not hurt our head and find out by reading.
A state superior court panel made the call in upholding the DUI conviction of a Lancaster County judge slapped on 33-year-old Danai Corbett of Coatesville. In the state's court's opinion, President Judge Emeritus Coriel F. Stevens rejected Corbett's claim that the county judge prevented his lawyer from asking a relevant question during his non-jury trial. Corbett fell afoul of the law by failing to signal while making a turn on a November 16, 2015. Trooper Pete Minko pulled him over and claimed he noticed a strong odor of the marijuana coming from Corbett's car. Although Corbett registered no alcohol intoxication from a breast test.
A breast test?
Nope, no booze in there. He failed field sobriety testing and showed visible signs of intoxication, including bloodshot eyes and a green tongue consistent with recent marijuana use.
What?
I don't know. Stick out your tongue. Let me see.
Here.
Nope, not green. I don't believe that's how it works. Uh-huh. Maybe they get like the dyed weed.
The dyed weed.
I don't know. How else would your tongue turn green?
During
court, is this what you call that there fake news? During Corbett's trial before County Judge Margaret C. Miller, the defense attorney asked Minko whether he had asked Corbett for permission to search his car. The prosecutor objected to that question, claiming it was irrelevant to whether Corbett was intoxicated. Miller sustained the objection. Corbett claimed on appeal to Stevens Court that the question was relevant and the failure to even try to find any marijuana in his car could have bolstered his argument that he was not, in fact, under the influence of the drug. Stevens didn't bite. Instead, he found the absence of marijuana didn't prove Corbett's innocence, especially since physical signs of his intoxication were evident to an experienced trooper.
I think your tongue turns green from gamma radiation. I think that they got that wrong. I think it was an Incredible Hulk deal from the 70s.
Wasn't Miss Piggy's tongue green too?
Yes, yes. There's also.
Do you think she was smoking weed?
No, it wasn't smoking weed.
Let's go to San Diego, California. California store clerk made a risky move to stop two suspected robbery suspects in a case of swift justice. Swift justice! San Diego police have just released video of the incident, which happened December 13th. In the video, You see the clerk try to prevent two women from leaving the store because he suspected they had stolen merchandise. A physical altercation ensued when the two refused to show the clerk what was in their bags. One of the suspects pulled a loaded .22 caliber revolver on the clerk. Now, is a .22 caliber, is that like a pea shooter?
Yeah, it's not very big, no.
Is he going to get a severe bruising from it?
No, a .22 can do some damage. It's not like a BB gun, but it's not like, let's put it this way, Dirty Harry wouldn't take you out.
The two grappled to the floor for a few seconds before the clerk wrenched the gun away from the woman. She then refused to leave the store until her gun was returned. The clerk refused to give the gun back, and after a drink of water, the suspect leisurely walked from the store. All right, that swift justice kind of sucked. I'm going to be honest with you. That was not the greatest version of swift justice I'd ever heard. Yeah. Let me see here. Yeah. Nope. I don't know what happened on this story, but it kind of vanished on me, so I'm going to have to look elsewhere. All right. Yeah, here we go, Tim. Here's a guy I can get behind. So we wrap up our dumb crimes and stupid criminals. I don't know. Should I just allow the news to tell the story, or should we tell the story, Tim? Let's tell the story. It's Florida Man.
Okay.
A Florida man told investigators he punched an ATM machine because it gave him too much cash, Tim.
Oh,
good
no.
Stupid machine. An arrest report says 23-year-old Michael Joseph Olesik. An arrest report says 23-year-old Michael Joseph Olesik, man, caused about $5,000 in damage to an ATM at a Wells Fargo Bank branch in Cocoa on November 29th. He was arrested December 22nd on a criminal mischief charge after bank officials decided to press charges. All right. Florida Today reports surveillance video capture Olesik pummeling the touchscreen. An arrest report says that Olesik told a bank manager he was angry that the machine was giving him too much money and didn't know what to do because he was in a hurry for work. He apologized for causing the damage. But at least he apologized.
Yeah.
But he wasn't going to take any more crap.
Oh, Florida.
You are a treat. Well, that's it for today, kids. Be kind, love one another. We'll see you again next week. Right here on True Crime Tuesday.